Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host Sam Moyen and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory and whatever else is going on. How are things, Sam? How are the reviews?
Well, David, they've been tough enough that, you know, the national conversation is getting too forbidding. And I just am feeling this yen to get down into the nitty-gritty of, you know, more state and local affairs.
Funny you should mention that. We have the perfect guest to talk about that. Who we have with us today, Dan Rodriguez of Northwestern Law School, Northwestern University Law School, a former dean and all-around hotshot. And we have Miriam Sefter, one of the great young scholars of local government law, state and local government law, and two really brilliant guests. And we had a really fun conversation. How was your experience getting down in the muck of state and local government law?
It was actually incredibly enlightening. And, you know, we can get into why that is later. There's so many topics that we've covered, and I think our listeners are in for a treat.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And also, one note before we get started, make sure you sign up for the newsletter for all updates on the podcast at diggingaholepodcast@gmail.com. You can enter into contests, win lots of swag. We had great entrants in our first contest about the movie Metropolitan, and we've got lots more coming. So with that, thank you so much. Let's get to the pod. We often go international and theoretical on this podcast, but for those of you who know me and my work know that I'm much more rooted than all of that, down in the weeds of state and local governance in America. So today, we have the perfect guests to take Sam down into the muck with us, talk about what's going on in state and local governments, both in practice and in scholarship. Miriam Sefter is an associate professor of law and the Roe Faculty Fellow in Regulatory Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She's, to my mind, the leading scholar about the institutions of state government. Her brilliant work on state administrative law, gubernatorial authority, and democratic qualifications, or lack thereof, of state legislatures is now foundational in the field. Daniel Rodriguez is an American operatic tenor from New York City. He's known as the singing policeman. Oh, wait a minute. That's a different Dan Rodriguez. This one hardly needs introduction. The former dean at San Diego and Northwestern Law School is the former head of the ALS, a terrific scholar, one of the leading figures in bringing positive political theory into the study of the administrative state and federalism, my co-author, and one of the best hangs in legal academia. Welcome to the pod.
Great. Glad to be here.
Are you gonna sing opera for us, Dan?
You know, I was going to sing because when I saw yours and Sam's podcast come out, I know it's called Digging a Hole, but I read it too quickly. I thought it was Fixing a Hole, which was to commemorate that great song from Sergeant Pepper's that came out before all of you guys were born. But no, it's the answer to your question.
You're not going to sing Alas.
Fixing a Hole or anything. Norma.
We're still early in the podcast, Dan. You might change your mind.
Yeah. There's the hole in the bucket, dear Liza, the whole thing. We could go in a lot of different directions.
All right. So this is a transgressive podcast for a couple reasons. One, which I just learned, is that though this is a Yale podcast, somehow each of the four of us went to Harvard Law School. But the main reason is that we've mixed it up. This is an extravaganza, and because it's about state and local government and I'm getting dragged down in the muck, but because we're going to do some rounds where, you know, the three of you great experts are going to explain to someone who's ignorant what's going on in the field and in the world. So I just want to start with, you know, welcoming both Miriam and Dan and asking them to tell us about the new things they're doing. So starting with Miriam, I understand you've started a new center. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Thank you for having me today. So we have a new initiative at Wisconsin Law School called the State Democracy Research Initiative. And the shortest version of the reason behind this is we have to understand state democracy to preserve it. But let me say a little bit more, if I may. So, you know, as you guys do not need me to tell you, state legislatures, executives, and courts really sit at the heart of the American democratic system. And if we needed more reminders of that, the 2020 election is one, and the onset of the pandemic is another, both stark reminders that state actors routinely make decisions every bit as consequential as the ones from their federal counterparts. And yet scholars and commentators and even advocates tend to fixate on the federal level while giving short shrift to the states. And I think that this is more than just a curriculum gap or, you know, the need for a little civics lesson. I think it's a real problem for state level democracy. And to make a point that may be kind of obvious, you know, law on the books is never enough. For law to do any work, someone has to pay attention to that law and understand it and invoke it. So it turns out that we cannot really protect democracy unless we are familiar with the institutions that compose it. And the flip side is also true. Opportunists can and do exploit inattention to states to pursue anti-democratic ends. So our new initiative was created in recognition for the need for more rigorous focus on the states. I am the faculty co-director along with my colleague and husband, Rob Yablon, and we have a terrific attorney, Allie Bolt, as our legal research director. And our mission is basically to offer expertise and resources on state-level democracy and governance to people who want it, to students, to the public, to policymakers, to advocates, to the media. And our hope is to be both a source of this work ourselves through our own research and also to be a hub for convenings and collaborations among people who are interested in this work.
Miriam, you hinted in what you just said that, you know, some potentially scary things are going on at the state level. At least those might lead some of us who, you know, have had their heads in the cloud to look down at the state level. On the other hand, there are all these incentives in legal academia not to do so. I mean, when I teach con law, we always, you know, observe that, you know, there are no economic and social rights in the federal constitution and through, you know, interpretation of it, and maybe mention that there are in states, but it's not like they're very, it's very rare that state constitutional law is taught, you know, Jeff Sutton and so forth has brought some attention to it. But I'm wondering if, like, whatever caused the absence of this topic will just keep doing so. Or do you think there's, you know, a moment of optimism thanks to your center?
I don't know if there's a moment of optimism, but I think there's definitely a moment of opportunity. I mean, for one thing, this inattention wasn't always the case. There are old con law treatises that are full of state con law, and I think there's a story to be told of the sort of unwriting of state constitutional law. But certainly, and Jeff Sutton's work is instrumental in this, you know, it's a time to think about the opportunities that exist to, you know, sort of when doors close at the national level. And so I think there is a renewed interest in state con law, and, you know, we hope to be able to facilitate that.
Okay, before getting too far into it, why don't we, you know, have Dan tell us what his blog is, which is, I hope, promisingly called Slog Blog.
Well, first of all, thank you, Sam and David, for inviting me. I'm really pleased to be here. Quite a lot of star power on this group, and as I did a little bit of due diligence, quite a lot of star power in your other guests, some of whom graduated from the Yale Law School. I noted. So happy to be here. Before I say a word about the blog, if I may, I have optimism. with respect to the growth in breadth and depth of attention to state constitutional law, thanks in no small part to the great work that's being done in the center that Miriam and Rob host at Wisconsin, many other places. If I could tell a very, very quick anecdote, when I began in law teaching back in the dark ages at UC Berkeley, my dean, very distinguished scholar of constitutional law, was meeting with me in his office, and I said about 2 years into my career that I wanted to teach a course in state and local government law. And he gave me some kind of the proverbial pat on the head and said, well, that's really very interesting, but you should wait until you get tenure to do that. You know, we don't do that sort of thing at a national law school like Berkeley. I think that anecdote is mostly anachronistic, although maybe not entirely so, but I think it illustrates exactly that point. I'd like to say that I was defiant and the rest was history, but I did wait until I got tenure and then proceeded. So it's not my blog, it is a blog. And in fact, kudos and shout out goes to the real mastermind behind it, which is our colleague, Meryl Chertoff, who was the longtime director, has had many really interesting, fascinating roles. I think she graduated here. From Yale. Exactly. And so where she is now is directs Georgetown's program on state and local government law. And she reached out to me and said, what about a blog? And my first instinct was not, you'll be happy to know, yes, because, you know, the world needs yet another blog. but Mariel didn't need to do a lot of convincing to me, and the two of us, I hope it's fair to say, didn't have to do a lot of convincing of some others, though some others, including Miriam and you, David, to bring a number of us together to really start this blog on issues involving state and local law. Now, lest you think that is sort of everything, from going to the Department of Motor Vehicles to getting a barbershop license to everything else, not that those aren't important considerations. This focus on state and local government is mostly on public law. So it covers a wide gambit from state constitutional law and administrative issues to certainly issues of localism, of local government law. It overlaps with, of course, a lot of blogs that are out there. But our agenda and objective in this fledgling project is to bring a really interesting, diverse set of contributors together to write and think and theorize and pontificate about contemporary issues in state and local government. Well, I say contemporary. One of our colleagues, Molly Brady, who teaches at Harvard, just put up on the blog a fascinating post on Confederate monuments and those particular issues, but also issues that are really hot off the presses. Slog Blog, as it's called, which may not win any awards for its alliterative title, is happily a place, and we hope will be the place for really some really interesting writing on these topics and issues. Yeah.
Though, Dan, if you think there's not going to be occupational licensing on there, you are deeply mistaken. I have a password and I know how to use it.
That's right. So we've seen, yes. We'll get you to a barbershop soon, yeah.
Okay, so having heard about these fantastic new initiatives, we really just want to have some rounds where each of you gets to talk about something substantively interesting that we should care about, those of us who don't yet. So we'll start with Miriam and just go through the three of you until David gets too annoying. What should I know about that's happening at the state and local level, and what's kind of interesting about it that would kind of occupy our minds as law professors?
Yeah, sure. So one topic I thought we could start with, because it brings together a lot of cross-cutting kind of themes that are going on at the state and local level, is a large wave of new state laws that limit executive power, most commonly over public health or emergencies, although there are some that touch on other topics too. Over half of states, according to some recent tallies, have now passed statutes like this. They vary in their scope, but the general blueprint is to strip power from the governor or another statewide health official and give it to the legislature. Some of these do things like they just ban executive branch actors from taking certain types of actions at all. Some of them limit the time periods of executive responses. Some of them vest a veto or rescission power over executive actions in constitutionally dubious committees within the legislature. I think to sort of kick us off on this, I'll leave the public health critique of these changes to experts in that field, because those critiques are available too. But I think of this as part of a bigger democratic problem. So to take a step back, it's a pretty common observation by now to say that it is becoming difficult for majorities to rule in the United States at the national level, that polarization and political geography interwork with institutional structure. But there are a few institutions left that still privilege majority control, and they're in the states. Governors, which is the focus of this topic, are an example of that. So are ballot initiatives and, dare I say it, state judicial elections. That's where, we still determine things by true majority votes. As a sort of aside, the same is not true of state legislatures, which, as I've written about in a recent paper, are increasingly counter-majoritarian, and many seem to be at work divesting power from their more majoritarian sibling branches. Happy to come back to that. I think what's important here is to think about this pattern of sort of burdening this trio of majoritarian institutions, burdening governors, taking their power away, making it harder to pass ballot initiatives, changing the way that we select state court judges. I'm gathering example of these in a new draft paper. And I think the bottom line for me is that it's troubling, and it's troubling not because I'm anticipating David here, not because any of these institutions themselves is always good. There's like lots of critiques that we can make that are legitimate of each of these institutions in isolation. But I think it would be problematic to miss that these are the spaces in which majorities can still prevail, including national majorities. And then it would be a mistake to make it so that there is nowhere for majorities to prevail. So hopefully that gives us a lot to chew on.
Yeah. So first of all, I want to say that there's a whole series of papers of Miriam's that this implicates, and you should read all of them. But I want to invoke another one of them, which I think is, so one of your terrific papers in this area talks about how governors are becoming more powerful, broadly speaking. And I wonder to what extent you think of this as a question of kind of a reciprocal kind of where both sides are making provocations against some kind of pre-existing status quo, that governors clearly aggregates a huge anger. They captured a great deal of power during the pandemic. You saw governors kind of just doing, kind of going crazy and running amok. And so what extent do you think that the gubernatorial legislative fight is one in which it's just legislatures kind of taking power for themselves, or is it one in which the governors are provoking and the legislature is responding? And one thing I'll note is that we have the same question to ask about localism stuff. So we have a huge set of fights about the new preemption. And it's seen as that the state legislatures are really smacking down city, kind of a whole variety of city policies. But of course, the same thing that drives the new preemption is driving cities to be more aggressive, that they're polarized from one another, they're politically different from one another, and they're pushing. So to what extent do you think that this is a mutual provocation, or is it really a situation in which the legislatures are kind of acting like jerks?
Well, I don't want to suggest that anyone's acting like a jerk, and I think it would be difficult to pin down sort of like the optimal equilibrium or even a historical equilibrium. So I think, you know, where my thoughts are going more is just to acknowledge on one hand, which I think is implicit in your question, governors have claimed a lot of power. And the previous article of mine that you allude to is really an exploration of the way that, sort of, for all the hand-wringing we have done about the certain powers that the president has, governors within their state often have like that, but supersized. And that produces sort of the highest highs and the lowest lows of executive power. So, you know, that's the backdrop against this. And that's why I say that gubernatorial power from a normative perspective is not always to the good. I mean, they certainly can overreach. But I think that, you know, if governors have been too cavalier in some respects during the pandemic, then the best adjustments to make after the fact are kind of incremental tailoring ones in which you respond to the problem that actually occurred. You know, but the notion that sort of forevermore, the executive branch will be subject to a committee veto within the legislature seems like an overcorrection that's likely to cause more problems than it solves.
Can I raise a real quick point? It actually harkens back to something Sam said when he said that con law types may miss out on some, you know, con law teachers on some unique features of state constitutions, like, for example, the existence of, positive rights and all of that. Here's another illustration, as Miriam, of course, and Dave, well, all of you know very well, and that is at the state level, we have something called a plural executive. And so Miriam talks about gubernatorial power and the ebbs and flows of that. But although, of course, there's some unique features in different states, to be sure, but we have something that it would really be, you know, horrifying for many folks who study the U.S. Constitution that exists at the state levels, which attorneys general elected separately, secretaries of state, and all of that. So maybe there's a question embedded here. I guess the question is, Miriam, does the existence of the plural and persistence of the plural executive bear on sort of the ebb and flow of gubernatorial power?
I mean, this may be a time to sort of invoke the, you know, separation of parties, not powers idea. I mean, I think the extent to which the plural executive meaningfully checks the governor has a lot to do with the politics of the people in those positions. I actually think that David has an interesting point about this in his recent post from the Slog Law blog this week, which we should all, of course, read regularly. I read that, David, as sort of a critique of the plural executive, that you think everyone should be appointed.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is where I would, when you said you were invoking your word, where I was going to respond, is that I would approach this much more strongly normatively than you would, which is that governors have democratic purchase and legislatures increasingly don't. And it's not just the malrepresentation caused by districting that we see in Congress and other places also, but rather that people have some idea who the governor is and have some capacity to understand what they've done in office, where legislative voting now tracks presidential voting about 99%. So if I know who you voted for president, I know who you voted for state legislature with almost very extremely little variation. And as a result, the that what two things should fall out from that. One is they also don't know who they voted for. Secretary of State also tracks vote for president. And two things should fall out from that. One is that the case for a unitary executive is more powerful the lower you go, even though the actual practice is that we have more plural executives the lower you go. That, like, I think there's a decently strong case for a directly elected federal attorney general. People might be able to pay attention to that. But at the level where they're voting for their county recorder of deeds or the people on the board of state universities, people have no idea what they're doing, and it makes more sense to vest authority in some politician that voters can actually respond to their performance. Further, when there's questions between executive and legislative disputes, I think, like, it's not just, like, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. It is a mutual provocation, but it's governors are better.
But let me invoke a little snark in this, David. I know you'll appreciate it, and that is, it makes me think that the title of your post is rather ironic, because of course the plural executive are precisely the kinds of progressive era reforms that that you would like to see erode fairly quickly.
Like, yeah, I said the end of, so again, it was, they're more of a Jackson era reform, but still, you know, they go back. But it's, I mean, this is now, I'm now getting to do one of my shticks, and so I Dad brought it on. So Sam, your MCing is completely but one thing I think that's been really interesting recently has been the that across a bunch of states, a lot of the progressive era institutions, and not just have eroded, or at least confidence in them has eroded. So I'm thinking of the recall election. California just had a recall election for governor. It lost. People are really angry about it. Lots of people are making, I think, somewhat legally tenuous arguments about its constitutionality. But even so, what they're expressing is a frustration with the system of recall elections exists in California, which is, I have to say, pretty dumb, but also was designed to be a kind of an anti-party logic to it. And similarly, in a lot of states, you're seeing a lot of pushback on the initiative and referenda. Mississippi Supreme Court just got rid of its initiative system through, again, kind of weird type of judicial interpretation. And you're seeing a lot of state legislatures just ignore initiatives and pass laws that go directly against them or frustrate them in one way or another. And you're also seeing a rejection of progressive style reforms in other states. Things like New York has a nonpartisan redistricting commission, but they're not going to listen to it. And they're instead going to go in kind of a full aggressive gerrymander. And the question, like, what explains all of this? And I think that Miriam's invocation of the Pildis Levinson separation of parties, not power. Like, this polarization eats everything. And one of the effects of this is that these progressive era institutions were designed to kind of be an anti-party logic, and they're kind of embedded deep in state constitutional law. But where polarization exists, the institutional structure is inconsistent with the politics. And people in con law, particularly in the kind of constitutional design literature, the, like, consociationalists and centripetalists and all those people who kind of get to do all the cool foreign junkets and write constitutions everywhere, they have this constitution creates politics view. But this suggests a different view, which is that politics also creates constitutional law.
Miriam, can I just go back to, you know, what I took to be a normative impulse, although, you know, David kind of pushed it even further. You know, in your initial statement, it sounded like you were saying, well, okay, there's excess in gubernatorial power, but at least there's majority rule somewhere still. And of course, that general concern, I think, is hugely relevant at the national level. But, you know, I guess I'm wondering, is there a defeatism in your view, insofar as it sounds like we just give up, like, legislatures for loss, and then we kind of burnish the credentials of executives because at least they're the last refuge of majority rule? Is that where you're going with this? And do we have to be that defeatist, or is there some way of retrieving, you know, what you might take to be the progressive idea, which is, like, self-rule through, like, large assemblies?
Yeah. So let me take this moment to reclaim some of the optimism that I sort of demurred earlier. I mean, I think there's lots of things that could be done to reform state legislatures to counteract some of the problems that I've written about. You know, I think that I have focused on the importance of salvaging executive branch power because it's the most sort of urgent and timely. Like, that's what's happening right now. And we need to sort of understand what's happening and talk about it in order to see why it could be a problem. But in the longer term, I mean, you know, this is sort of beyond the scope of my recent papers, but sure, there's, like, lots of as you well know, lots of proposals for different ways to select legislatures that would, I think, go a long way towards eliminating or at least significantly mitigating the problems that that I've written about. I mean, there's, you know, there's proposals for multi-member districts. There's proposals for various forms of proportional representation. There's proposals for a sort of mixed New Zealand style system. And I think we should, think about those longer term solutions. Absolutely. I just think that, you know, in the moment, it would be a shame to let this wave of statutes pass without observing what it's doing to the opportunity for majority rule.
Okay, totally convincing. But let's pass on to Dan now. It's your turn. You know, the floor is open for you to introduce what you think is most interesting now.
I like where the floor's been. So let me riff a little bit on what we've talked about, because it will get to where I want to talk about, which is sort of COVID federalism. Again, not a phrase I've coined, but something that's very much on my mind. I'll just make the observation that some of which this conversation has been having is a bit abstract. I like abstract and I like theoretical, so that's not a criticism, but there's a sense of majoritarianism for what end. And I'm struck by David's comment about polarization eats everything. The pushback from the legislature, the pushback in states to kind of pull back on some gubernatorial power doesn't come from, they picked up their pocket copy of the Federalist Papers and are rethinking the foundations of government. A lot of it has been COVID related, right? This red state or red legislature push back to the over what they see as the overbearing role and exercise of authority in the public health emergencies now many months. I know that's not all of it. Maybe it's not even most of it, but it's a lot of it. And so I just want to flip the script and say that while there are some really important democratic principle theoretical arguments that will help orchestrate and organize our thinking about should we favor the power of the governor or favor the power of the legislature, we're also in a period in which our house is on fire. And the concern, the dread that I and many others have about efforts to dissolve or limit the power of the governor is not just a sort of maybe a democratic principle argument. And I'm not suggesting that's where Miriam comes out. It's just at the level of high principle. But it's about, do we want public health authorities under the aegis of the governor making important decisions? Did we want them making important decisions in March of 2020? I'll answer my same question. Hell yes. And to do so quickly and not to devolve that power to the legislature. Do we want governors who are in a position, just in terms of the structure of government, to follow the science, as it were, more effective than a multi-member legislature? And not, by the way, just because that a bunch of the governors are Democrats versus Republicans, but because of the measure of authority and public health emergency authority and all of that. Yes to that. And if you say, well, can you give us an example outside of COVID? I'll talk about literally fires, not just metaphorically fires, like the ability to combat significant. So all of which is to say that before we think of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, we ought to think about the as I'm sure many of us do, about the peril and continuing perils that are associated with this rather remarkable public health emergency, which brings me to COVID federalism. I think I just will put out there an issue that's very much on my mind and many others is classic issues of localism, right? State and local authority and the distribution of power that exists within the states. That's an oldie but a goodie, right? That goes back in many respects to the emergence of home rule authority and preemption and Dillon's rule and all these things that us local government lawyers love. That is persistent in this environment, especially in the battle over COVID. And I'm speaking of, for example, the battles in Florida and in Texas and in Arizona, where red state governors are invoking powers to limit the scope of municipalities, which tend to be purple, if not downright blue. To expand the scope of authority, requiring masks and requiring others, and we could debate about the state constitutional power of governors to do that. But I'll just simply put a pin in that issue and say that has created an enormous wave of conflicts and controversies. Some of which have arisen in courts. Some of which have become moot, by the way, as governors have backed off. But that has just as an illustration of the lively struggle over over state and local relations in the context of a deep and dire and continuing public health emergency.
So I'll throw something else in there to make it even more deep and dire, which is that one of the things that struck me about our COVID federalism is that we have that one of the kind of classic federalism arguments about laboratories of democracy. And one of the things, although we've devolved huge amounts of authority to state and local governments, they have not been particularly creative in their responses to, you've not seen the kind of rich experimentation one might have expected in this area. But what you have seen is that the laboratories of democracy have a bunch of lab leaks, that the facts of differing policies along COVID have prolonged the emergency everywhere as people go from high risk areas to low risk areas. And so I wonder whether that this is a instance, or when we think about the reflection of COVID on federalism and on localism, this is a going to be a kind of a centralized, an argument for centralized authority across both those systems. And so that the new efforts for that we might see kind of greater attention, again, all things being equal, a push towards federalization, but for Dan and I think that like there's been a big new movement that Dan referenced and kind of spoke positively of kind of pushback on state authority over local governments. But the same types of moves are available in state versus local, which is that any local government who doesn't want to allow something or wants to, you know, in the context of a pandemic, is going to have external effects. And you've seen in other jurisdictions. So, in California, the governor cracked down on Huntington Beach and other areas where they were extremely lax. And so I wonder whether COVID is going to be at least a normative, kind of in the world of ideas, if not necessarily in the world of politics, for centralization rather than decentralization.
I think it's happening now. I think you're exactly right. And the pressure upwards from, at least two overwhelming. One is the fact that we've used almost as a trope that, you know, we're in a borderless environment and, you know, you can't, but how else to think about that in the context of a contagion that, you know, as the trite phrase goes, doesn't respect Republican Democrat states, right? So the notion that states can act like New Zealand or maybe one state can, Hawaii, but the rest can't. And so the ubiquity of these issues across the United States makes us wonder, what exactly are we getting from letting Mississippi experiment in California, and then just 6 months later figuring out, you know, the death rate and saying, oh, you win, California. And the second is just what you said at the beginning, which I think is really quite important. And that is, we're all coming from essentially the same playbook. So the notion that there is true experimentation and really, you know, kind of different kinds of approaches that are being utilized by different state governors and state legislatures, I think is naive. They tend to fall back on what the standard is. And that doesn't give us a lot of confidence if we think about the laboratories of experimentation idea.
It seems like there might be a countervailing force here, though, that David alluded to earlier, which is kind of like an increasingly confident or aggressive or defiant posture on the part of local governments. For all that's been written, preemption, right? The hyper preemption, the idea that states are becoming, you know, extremely aggressive in their preemption of local governments. You could sort of infer that local governments are kind of left with nothing, right? That they have no tools in their tool belt to respond to that. And it seems like one thing that has come out of the last couple of months is a lot of examples that seem to be local governments saying, like, you know, I mean, it's sort of the new no thank you. Like, well, you know, we see your mandate, but we're actually going to go ahead with our masks. Or we understand that litigation is pending, but we're going to hold off on, you know, adhering to that court decision until there's a final judgment that binds us. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's an overread. Maybe that's just because, you know, these local governments really think that they're in the right and that they'll ultimately prevail. But it seems like the kind of posture that at least sort of raises the cost of preemption for the state, because now they have to deal with, you know, taking this sort of all the way to its end and not just saying like, well, we passed this law, so you'll all fall in line.
Yeah, so I think that's really interesting. I mean, of course, we've had a theme of this politics for a long time. It's anti-commandeering is a similar move, right? So can the government actually force anyone to do anything? So there's constitutional protections, but there's also the fact that most people who work for government work for local government. a huge majority of them work for local government. And we had this through the Trump era, in the pre-pandemic Trump era, the should local police departments cooperate with ICE is a similar type of movement. Cities are resisting using their tools to do so. And so, and you could think about this normatively, positively, or normatively. In some ways, it's a nullification crisis, right? So it's a, on another hand, it is dissenting by deciding. And so this is a kind of ongoing theme, but it has certainly reared its head very dramatically during the COVID era.
There's also a dog that doesn't bark feature to this, by the way. You know, those of us who followed these cases so closely, maybe 12 months ago, 9 months ago, thought, oh, well, we're going to see massive litigation. You know, we're going to really test these principles of local government law and Dillon's rule and home rule and preemption and statutory interpretation across, you know, 20. I mean, Tucson's going to be sued by, you know, Arizona. And we haven't seen a lot of that. So to Miriam's point, not only has there been some defiance on the part of local governments, but they have stood in the way of threats. Now, maybe they're just paper threats, ultimately, to bring them to, you know, even Florida, right? The threats to take away the pay of local school officials has, you know, you don't read a lot about that. And I think in large part, the judgment has been, that's a bridge too far. So we haven't seen, and I think happily, all of this erupt in litigation where state courts have been at the front lines deciding. There have been some cases, but not nearly as much as I might have suspected about states winning this against local governments or local governments winning this against state governments.
Miriam lives in Wisconsin, where all of the cases go. So it's a
maybe I'm missing out on, if I lived in Wisconsin or in Michigan and some other places, it'd be a different, somewhat different story.
Okay, so I think it's David's turn.
Yeah. So during the federal response to the pandemic, one of the features of the federal response was an extraordinary amount of state and local fiscal aid. The people sitting in March of 2020, everyone, expert thought that most states were going to have a huge fiscal crisis, that the last recession created a huge problem for states and local governments. State taxes are now much more cyclical than they used to be because states rely so much more on income and capital gains taxes. And everyone thought that with the coming of the COVID recession, state and local governments were going to be flat broke. And we're going to see a wave of bankruptcies, a huge number of problems. And the nature of what happened economically, both because of the federal responses, not with respect to states, you know, that what the Federal Reserve did and other aspects, stimmies, and the nature of the type of recession we had, in which high-income people did much better, the K-shaped recovery, meant that state and local budgets didn't do that badly, at least in aggregate. Particularly states that were very reliant on income taxes and states that had changed their sales taxes to tax internet sales. Both of those buoyed state budgets during this period. Now, there are some governments who suffered quite a lot, governments reliant on transit fares and oil and a couple other things. But most states did pretty well. Some states actually saw revenue increases. And yet, Congress gave giant boatloads of money to state and local government, one of the biggest state and local aid packages in American history. And this raises a question. The traditional critique of federal aid to state and local governments is that it creates moral hazard, that states, knowing that they are going to get, if they have run into any trouble, they're going to get buckets of money from the federal government, they will not need to budget responsibly going forward. Two things that kind of spring from this. Jonathan Rodden famously argued, he wrote a book a couple of years ago, he's not Taylor Swift or anything, but famous in our world, argued that where the federal government gives lots of aid to states, it will put very strong conditions on it. Because if the federal government's going to be paying for something, they don't want state to avoid the moral hazard, they put strong conditions on it. And you saw this in the Biden ARP, where there was a rule that said that states couldn't use the money to cut taxes, and that's currently in litigation right now. It's a fascinating piece of litigation. A second question is the moral hazard concern correct? Over the course of American history, it is certainly proved correct over time. So the Hamilton's assumption of state debts was associated with a very large increase in lending to state and local governments and a widespread belief among lenders that the federal government was standing behind states, which eventually led to the defaults of 8 states and a territory in the 1840s. But will this create moral hazard? Well, there's some reasons to think no, which is that the aid went to all states. It wasn't didn't just go to bankrupt ones, it went to all states. On the other hand, aid is more valuable to states that are more spendthrift. And one thing we've seen post-aid is that the spreads between interest rates on bonds issued by like the most fiscally risky states and localities and the least have compressed substantially, which suggests the federal bond market is at least pricing in some degree of assumption that the federal government will stand in the next time a state and local government has a fiscal crisis. So the question that is going to emerge in the next couple of years is to what extent are states going to use their federal aid and act like Brewster's Millions? Are they just going to be throwing money left and right? In some states, it looks like this is what's happening. If you followed what's happening in New York State and New York City, it certainly seems like they're not, they're not saving, putting things away for a rainy day. In other states like Connecticut has really saved a huge amount of its money. So the question I think that is worth thinking about is if federal aid is going to be a larger part of our life, is it going to actually create moral hazard?
So I'll jump in on that. So much in that, really very interesting. So much of it depends on how we configure our sense of what is or is not a moral hazard. So let me push hard on your description of throwing away, which you use as a juxtaposition to, rainy day funds and fiscal prudence, and maybe something like tax rollbacks and all of that. So let's stipulate that those would be, fiscally responsible, all things considered approaches. What I see, and I haven't drilled down in the data in a great degree, obviously from your question less than you have, but my surmise is that what some of this spending, rapid spending, substantial spending, which some might characterize as throwing money away, has been utilized to basically save and salvage major parts of the economy, like restaurants, bars, and others. Institutions that have been remarkably resilient, but still very precarious during this period of the pandemic. And even if the pandemic slowed down appreciably in the next 3 to 6 months, which I'll leave to the public health experts to make a prediction about whether it will, those industries, tourist industries and others are really, really on very shaky ground. And so that's not going to solve itself instantly. And, we can look at the glass half full in many respects by looking at travel data and looking at, what happens when Broadway comes back and, all of that. But if you dig deeper into the data, you'll see that there are, there are kind of tourist deserts in many parts of the country. There are restaurants that really are disappeared and won't come back with all the, of course, effects that it has on the economy. So if I did look at the data, and I'd be surprised if I didn't see an enormous amount of subvention by state and local authorities to big parts of the economy. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say they've always calculated that right. They've done so only for the most noble of purposes, in equilibrium, all of those businesses should have persisted to a greater degree. But before I would be confident in accepting the notion that this money has been thrown away or creates a moral hazard, I'd want to evaluate, more fine grain. And I'm not suggesting you're saying that, but I'm just in terms of the fear, I'd want to know exactly how that money has been utilized.
Yeah, I think the bigger question is not, is the money wasted right now? Because, who knows? It's a lot of the good programs. But rather, is it being spent in a way that will be consistent with pulling it back when the federal aid stops, right? So if it's genuinely emergency aid, then the fact that it's running through states is basically, maybe the states are smarter at it, maybe they're dumber than the federal government in this respect. But that's a temporary question. But if the question, I think, is not about the budget this year and the budget next year, but whether the effect this aid has in the budget 4 years ago, are they cutting taxes in ways that they were not going to be able to raise taxes in the future? And that's what the limit was meant to do in the act. And their states are going to be able to cut taxes. Or are they creating programs where they're hiring lots of people who they're not going to be able to fire 3 years from now because it's very hard to fire people? And so I think that's the question, not is the money being spent well now today? Because again, I'm sure lots of it is being spent well today. Some of it is, some of it isn't, but rather, are we creating the conditions for the next fiscal crisis? And what could we do, if anything, to avoid it? Or is that an inevitability?
And I probably said too much already. I'll say just really shortly, I worry about that. I think the moral hazard for just the way you've laid out is a substantial worry.
Okay, so we'll have one more round and turn back to Miriam for her other amazing idea that is roiling.
That's hard to pull ourselves
in
away.
The states, I know, and local from, government realm.
From David's topic. But I want to, I think I want to, for my second story, I want to talk about state con law, because we would be remiss, especially given your comment, Sam, if we didn't pay some attention to state con law. So one way into that is to think about the relationship between state constitutions and ballot initiatives, which David also mentioned, and in particular, the recent sort of blizzard of proposals to limit or burden ballot initiatives in the last couple of years. If you haven't been following these, you know, there's a whole array of them that have been moving through state legislatures. Some of them impose new signature or distribution requirements. So they mandate that proponents get higher percentages of signatures from more parts of the state in order to get onto the ballot. Some of them have tried to cap the percentage of signatures that could come from any one district. I think the most sort of preposterous, or at least the most entertaining, is South Dakota's, which combines a requirement that all the signatures fit on one page with a font size requirement, like 14 point font. So the proponents have to carry around these sort of bed sheets sized petitions, which is just, you know, sort of impractical. So I think, you know, from our first conversation, we've already talked a little bit about why these developments are normatively concerning, right? Because they burden majority rule in one of the last places where it is left. But there's also a state con law angle. And I think that the laws themselves and the case law that's brewing and that's still to come really indicate the promise of what Jessica Bullman Posen and I have called the democracy principle in state constitutions. So a quick primer on that. Basically, the crux of the democracy principle idea is that state constitutions repeatedly and expressly espouse democracy, namely the pillars of majority rule, popular sovereignty, and political equality, in ways that the federal constitution does not, despite, you know, admirable efforts of people to find hooks in the federal constitution for those kinds of values. State constitutions begin with a commitment to the people's power. They structure their government, as I've described, in ways that allow majorities to rule. They expressly protect the right to vote. They allow feasible amendment, and on and on. And this principle is an important resource in the wave against ballot initiative burdens. So I just wanted to briefly illustrate with a case that's a recent decision from the Idaho Supreme Court, where basically in 2018, Idaho voters expanded Medicaid. And since then, the legislature has been endeavoring to make ballot initiatives harder to pass, despite the fact that Idaho is hardly a state with easy rules for getting on the ballot or any indications, I think, of abuse of the process. I think in the past 8 years, 14 petitions were circulated and only two qualified for the ballot. But this new Idaho law that passed was supposedly the most stringent in the country. It would have required, or for the time that it was in effect, did require a threshold number of signatures from all of the state's 35 legislative districts. And advocates were basically saying that this, you know, would have taken it from very hard to get on the ballot to basically impossible to get on the ballot. And in late August, the Idaho Supreme Court struck down the new law, and I think, again, sort of showcased the opportunities within state con law. And the court, you know, the decision comes out and says the state constitution begins with the premise that all political power is inherent in the people, and that, you know, the people reserve to themselves this legislative power, and they called that a fundamental right that warrants strict scrutiny. And they also kind of, you know, cut through what I see as some of the problematic posturing around these ballot initiatives, you know, because often, and this I think goes to some of David's critique of them, you know, often it's easy to say, well, there's the potential for these to not be majoritarian. And in fact, there's, you know, going further than what I think David said, there's the potential for ballot initiatives to really be the sort of trammeling of minority interests, because there's such a unmediated form of majority rule. And what the court said was, well, you know, we hear that argument, but what we see is an unmistakable pattern by the legislature. This is a quote, an unmistakable pattern by the legislature of constricting the people's initiative and referendum powers after they successfully use it. And then in terms of the, you know, trampling minority interests, the court said, you know, that's a possibility. And it's an important thing to guard against, but there was just no evidence of it. You know, it's certainly not in the form of Medicaid expansion. And so I think that this is a line of cases to watch. And I think that this particular opinion got it quite right.
So kind of help me, because, you know, in a way my mind is blown that it turns out that, you know, below the level of the federal constitution, there are all these constitutions that are way more pro-democratic. But then, you know, you tell this story in one paper that the legislatures are less and less majoritarian. And you tell this kind of, you know, ambivalent story about executives. What's the significance, I guess, of what's on paper? It seems like it has to be that contingently there are these state Supreme Courts that are really to defend like the much more kind of pronounced pro-democratic credentials of state constitutions. And it just seems, first, is it contingent or is it even, you know, kind of rare given that where did the judges come from, et cetera? So, I mean, could you just spell out the story to give us a sense of like how much we can expect the judges to play the pro-democratic role that, you know, we might think the constitutions demand?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think more than you might think, right? Like in our paper, Jessica and I gather examples from a number of states that really fit this mold where, you know, and partly I think because the resources in state constitutions are just expressed, right? They don't leave much to the imagination. And so I do think there is a pattern of courts invoking this principle in recent cases and also in older cases. Now, that's not to say that obviously it's not a suggestion that state courts will always do this and that, you know, state courts are never sort of partisan in their operation. I mean, there's a huge literature on the behavior of elected judges, and some of it does indicate that, you know, there's certain rulings in favor of donors, for example. I'm thinking of work by Michael Kang and Joanna Shepherd. But I think the democracy principle is longstanding. And I think that although it is contingent on its enforcers, just like all law is, I think that it has, you know, a sufficient rooting in the document itself and sufficient precedent that it's something that can be confidently relied upon. And I would also just add, it's not only state courts, right, who can draw upon this, right? Like it's the kind of thing that if it becomes part of the sort of popular imagination and understanding of state constitutions, David, your faces are hilarious, that can, you know, it can animate other discussions, right? So if you're on, you know, a redistricting commission or you're, you know, within state government, I think there are other opportunities for people to draw upon these ideas who are not themselves deciding the cases.
Can I jump in on that? So here's a dark side, at least a dark side from the vantage point of progressives. So there are instances, to go to your question, Sam, of the state courts, the state Supreme Court standing up in the name of we the people and democracy as against rights claims. So there's a whole line of cases before Obergefell involving state Supreme Court striking down claims for marital equality and doing so in language about democracy and the initiatives that define marriages, a marriage between a man and a woman. There are some other contrary cases. There's Massachusetts and others, but the lion's share of these cases were invoked in the name of democracy to protect victims' Bill of Rights. When that was all the wave in the 70s and 80s, courts standing in saying democracy. And in California, we had the experiment, continuing gift that keeps on giving of Proposition 13, and the efforts on the part of the courts in a series of cases that are sort of somewhat forgotten, but still nonetheless important. I think go to Miriam's point of the courts, and that was 1978, in the 80s and in the 90s, in case after case, resisting efforts that local governments were doing to adapt to the world of Proposition 13 and saying, no, the voters voted. And the voters voted, you know, to put these, you know, Ulysses tied to the mast restrictions on local government's tax authority. So from the vantage point of progressives and rights-based claims, positive and negative, this invocation of democracy that the courts have made has sometimes had a real dark side.
So I want to add that Miriam's that invocation of initiatives is this kind of pro-democratic thing. There's, I have two minds about it, because one, the evidence that voters know what's going on in initiatives is been a long subject of scholarly inquiry. The best evidence, as far as I can tell, is that where it's a super high profile initiative, voters are able to use cues from endorsing groups. And then as you have more of them, voters get increasingly less sophisticated. And further, it's not the kind of area where you could really do without some kind of judicial regulation. We have always had the single subject rule, for instance, we need something, because the classic one is like, what about initiatives that devote more than 100% of the state's budget to something, that kind of thing. And so on one hand, I've always been quite skeptical of Democratic moves towards initiatives on the grounds that it's like asking voters to do something they can't do, and that representative rather than unmediated democracy outperforms. On the other hand, in a world where legislatures, as Miriam well notes, are increasingly determined by national party preference, and there are latent majorities that are not being emerged, they're impossible to emerge, even latent supermajorities that are very hard to emerge because of the way in which voters who know nothing about state legislatures and vote for the president are not able to, we don't give them the tools to express their opinions. Initiatives play a pretty important role in allowing those latent majorities to emerge. And I think Medicaid expansion in a bunch of these states is one of them. It's very, very, very popular. It's not getting through Republican legislatures. And so on one hand, I think like Miriam overdoes it by invoking these initiatives as like purely or uncomplicatedly democratic, in the sense of if we mean that accountable and representative. On the other hand, I think that like there are definitely ways, given our current institutional form, in which they definitely are.
Yeah. So, I mean, I want to respond to both of these. So first of all, David, I do agree with you. I mean, I think that, they're pro-democratic in the terms of what I would think of as again, like constitutional opportunity, right? They're this avenue through which majorities, determined majorities, can do things that they cannot do through other institutional structures. But I actually do agree with you that there's a lot that could be done to improve voter information. I think of that as sort of like tinkering with the design of these things to make them, you know, as successful as they can be. And I'm not opposed to that at all. I actually think it's really important. There's some success stories and some not success stories on that score. To Dan's point, you know, I think it's impossible to disagree with you, Dan, that there can be a dark side to these. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. But I think it would be too simplistic, and I don't think you were suggesting this, to suggest that sort of the preference of the majority is always to infringe upon liberties or individual rights. I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence that's actually the exact opposite of that, that a lot of what's being done with these initiatives is things like expanding the franchise. So I think that we shouldn't paint with too broad a brush when we think about the downsides. And of course, you know, these systems work together, right? So to the extent that they are, you know, in your example from the marriage cases, you know, to the extent that they are infringing individual rights, it's important that there remain federal constitutional rights that exist as a backstop as well.
Totally agree. And Sam, back at the beginning of this, or Sam or David, I forget. I mean, you guys are just so alike. I can't tell you the two apart, but noted recall, which is fresh in our mind, is, oh my God, what a big waste of money. You know, I was in California, the first recall, and there's a lot of us, maybe this is an unpopular take, who thought, thank God that Gray Davis was recalled. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger, who maybe we had very low hopes for, helped redefine California politics in some way. So I'd say it's one win and one loss. It's the referendum on the recall.
Okay, the third one will decide whether it's good or bad. But we'll close by letting you, Dan, give us your second kind of hot topic.
So I'll do a quick one that's very much on my mind. It is cannabis federalism. So we have this fascinating predicament in modern American government. Cannabis possession of any amount is, contrary to what may be popular belief, illegal under federal law. It has been for now a half century. It is a Schedule I. Marijuana is like heroin and fentanyl and LSD, a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substance Act that has not been repealed. So I'm not, this podcast does not give legal advice, and I'm not giving legal advice, but if you're walking around with some marijuana in Colorado and you're wrapping yourself up in the notion that it is legal, so I cannot be arrested, you are incorrect. On the other hand, we now have 36 states and counting that have legal medical marijuana, 18 states and counting that have legal recreational marijuana, and that is a real puzzle, how we can be in an environment in which we have the rapid, steady erosion of prohibition against marijuana possession at the state level, and indeed a big business, and I mean a really, really big cannabis business with revenue flowing from it and decline in income tax rates and all of that because of this money flowing in from cannabis while still persistently having the illegality under federal law. So that raises some interesting federalism issues. I'll simply also say, though, it raises some interesting local issues. Even California, which you think would be at the forefront of, oh, sure, pot should be legal, every day, all the time, has a number of cities, a very large number of municipalities that have prohibited dispensaries to operate in their local government. And there's some interesting litigation as we speak about whether home delivery of marijuana, which a number of companies, you know, Uber of pot, if you think about it that way, to deliver in those areas in which dispensaries cannot operate, is or is not consistent with state preemption law. So there's a lot going on in the cannabis federalism area, state, local, federal, state, federal, local, and the like. And once again, there's big money in this. So not just interesting legal issues.
So I think that is an unbelievably fascinating issue. And I wish I could sit in on your class that you're teaching on this, because that sounds awesome to me. Not just because I was randomly punching buttons on my iPhone for no reason, looking for Uber, like Uber, but for ? No, it's a, but I mean, two things that spring out from that. One is your last discussion, which is that it's actually all about zoning. Is actually a good answer for almost about most public policy questions, and that zoning politics is one of the more interesting things happening in state government. But the other one that I think highlights is the degree to which, for a lot of very hot button social issues, we have nationalized them. So drugs being a kind of classic one, and their efforts to denationalize them. And so the state legalization of marijuana is an example of an effort to take a hot button national issue and come up with allow Coloradans to be different from people from Alabama or nutmeggers from Connecticut.
And your point, can I jump in, David? Yeah. The laboratories of experimentation is absolutely rife in the marijuana legalization effort. So there isn't one standard playbook. And what Illinois, Massachusetts, Wisconsin, California does, Connecticut, is really, really different across the state.
And the thing, though, that this highlights for me is the coming great question for state and local government, going to be the next year's biggest question, which is what happens when issues have clear extraterritorial effects and are hot button social issues that state legislatures care about. So this is what will happen if Roe is overturned in state politics, because it's going to become the single biggest or a single biggest issue. It's going to be the choice of law Olympics in the sense of like what extent can states impose regulations on people who are out of state? How can they burden interstate travel? All of these things are what's going to happen to drugs that are used for abortions. Are they going to be as easily available as, I don't know, fentanyl or cocaine? Or are they going to be more regulated than illegal drugs or what? I think that this is a coming huge issue. One case for traditional argument for federalism has always been that it allows for the diffusion, like taking the sting out of kind of the hottest button issues by allowing people from Texas and people from New York have to have different answers. But in a world of a truly national market, that is more challenging than it might seem. And so I'm curious what you guys all think about that, because I think that this is like, well, if we did this 12 months from now, like, this is what we'd be talking about.
Yeah. So I'm still thinking about your question, David, but what I was tempted to say in response to Dan is really actually just goes back to where we started with this conversation, which is a plug for state and local government law, because, you know, one thing that I think is readily apparent in the marijuana federalism space is that you understand the law by looking at the national law, right? It's not actually an accurate description of the law that an individual would have to follow. And in fact, you can't understand it by looking at just the state law alone, right? These laws are, a function of sort of these negotiated arrangements in different states, negotiated upwards vertically, negotiated downwards vertically. And so, I think that in terms of scholarship, I think that's a really important space right now is the folks who are writing about, you know, Jessica's work on executive federalism, the work that Bridget Fahey's doing, explaining sort of the relationship between, the structures of state government, the structures of other states' governments, and also of the federal government. So I think that is for scholars, that is an important area to watch as all of these interrelations become more apparent.
Yeah, Bridget's work is mind-blowing on this. It's so cool.
Can I jump in and say, so David, you wrote this wonderful article a few years ago with also a wonderful title, Stuck. And I know you've been writing, as some others, on issues of mobility. Tebow didn't invent this debate, but of course ushered in a wave of really, really interesting work that continues among those who study law and law and economics and what have you. And to me, it comes back to the heart of these issues. When I think about, you know, the coming, you know, perilous world in which there's, you know, abortion federalism and, you know, the issues of cannabis federalism and all of that, much of my own priors and views turn on predictions about how mobile are humans, as you know, in the workforce and others. And I don't just mean across state boundaries, but across local boundaries. So you know, this debate, which is both normative and descriptive, right, and data driven about how folks move around and where they're, you know, shopping for their next home and their next job and all of that, is really, really important to understand and to get right in understanding both how the law reflects those choices in important ways, and also how the law impacts those choices in various different ways. And so I think there's just a lot more that we need to know about in order to drive some of these legal principles.
Yeah, I think that is bringing us back to one of the questions Sam started us off with, which is like, how is this interesting to us national level folks? Well, this is really the question of to what extent are we going to let federalism, kind of American legal federalism, get in the way of the national market? That this is the central question in European Union regulation, but we are really asking the question through whether it's questions like kind of real hard limits on moving, like not building houses because of land use restrictions, or whether it's limits on labor mobility through things like occupational licensing. See, I got that in there, Dan. Or whether it's things like having such different legal regimes in different places that it limits our capacity to move around for economic or other purposes, and it really will become more responsive to legal responses. The productivity of the U.S. economy is in large part driven by the fact that we have a national market for labor and for goods, and to the extent we let or encourage states to resolve our political conflicts by adopting different answers, we very well may stand in the way of that. That one way to put this, that I put it in the past, is that there's a real conflict between agglomerative efficiency, or the gains of people moving for economic purposes, and Tebow sorting. And that those are two values. They're both interesting, important values, but they're in pretty direct conflict.
Yep.
All right. This has been amazing. You know, at the beginning, David, you know, I don't know, promised or warned that I'd get dragged down into the muck, but on the contrary, I've had my consciousness raised, and I know our listeners will feel the same way, whether or not they have used newly available cannabis, to get there. I want to really thank Dan and Miriam for coming on this show, which has been fantastic.
And check out the blog. We're all on it. We're partying online.
Right. And the podcast. Check out this terrific podcast. Thanks for letting us drop in.
Thanks for a great conversation.